It was Stalin who had invaded six Western neighbors between 1939 and 1941, alarming the Germans and other neighbors who were afraid of being devoured. Next, the Soviet invasions of Finland and Romania had backfired spectacularly, as these countries were now fighting alongside the German Wehrmacht to redeem their honor and regain their lost territory. Welcome to Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone in the Libertarian Institute. That is a quote from Stalin's War, A New History of World War II by Dr. Sean McMeekin, historian, PhD at Bard College. Mr. McMeekin, where is the best place to purchase this book?
Well, I think you'll find it in fine bookstores just about anywhere. It is also available at Amazon, of course, from my publisher, Basic Hachette. I hope it isn't too difficult to find it. Sometimes we do book signings if events are organized in such a way. But I guess these days there aren't that many bookstores left in America. But hopefully if you have a good one in your town or there's a Barnes & Noble nearby, you can find it there.
It was at the Changing Hand bookstores in Arizona. So right. Yes, it's at quite a few places. Dr. McMeekin, why is history important?
Well, I suppose there are a lot of cliches. One wants to know history so that one doesn't repeat it. I don't think history ever repeats exactly. It's often been said it may not repeat, it rhymes. I just think that if you haven't grappled with history and it's sometimes painful and awkward lessons, you're not really going to live a full life. That is, you're not going to fully understand the world that you live in. I think it adds perspective, and in particular, something I think Americans could benefit from, in part because this is a country that has always at least pretended to create itself de novo. I think Americans could learn from the tragic sense in history. That is, the idea that things don't always turn out for the best, that no matter how bad things are, they still could be worse. So that in that sense, we maybe adjust our expectations and also try a little harder to work at making the world a better place.
There is a great dismissal of any research in this area where you can look at it, call it revisionist history, and now you never have to address any of the claims because you've put it in the revisionist category with David Irving and people questioning the Holocaust. How do you respond to someone who says, oh, this book is revisionist history?
Well, I certainly hope they're not going to put me in a category with David Irving. I mean, some of Irving's work is still worth reading, but obviously he's been essentially kind of turned into a pariah by the historical establishment because of the Lippstadt trial and Holocaust denialism and all the rest of it. You're right. I mean, sometimes books simply get pigeonholed, and these days no one's going to read David Irving anymore. Sometimes people get dismissed, as you put it, as revisionist or counterfactual historians are kind of treated as not serious by the establishment, perhaps not treated quite as brutally as David Irving has been. But that is, books like mine, which are seen as revisionist, if we question some of the premises of, let's say, the Allied victory and Allied propaganda in the war, or some of the war's outcomes as perhaps being less than ideal, particularly in Eastern Europe and Northern Asia. You're right. I mean, I think there is this tendency to dismiss histories that kind of argue certain points or point at other avenues or paths that history might have taken, to dismiss them as revisionism. I personally have never really understood this line of thinking. The idea that we should all just agree on one kind of rather tame and almost safe, smoothed over, polished, buffed and polished kind of history that's very reassuring and just agree on that. Why don't people want to be challenged? I don't really see what the point is of writing a book if you're just going to agree with what everyone else has said. If you're just going to tell the same story in perhaps a slightly different way. Admittedly, most of the book buying public doesn't agree with me, and people love those books. I mean, you look at your traditional sort of World War II narrative that buffs up the Allies, the great heroic fight against fascism, Banded Brothers, et cetera, et cetera. Those books do sell. There's no gainsaying that. I like to think that my own audience, those who actually want to learn new things, perhaps is a bit smaller, but perhaps a little more discerning.
There was an economist at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, who was talking about the importance of history. His name is Hans Hermann Hoppe. He says, because the general public is not used to or capable of abstract reasoning, high theory, and intellectual consistency, but forms its political views and convictions on the basis of historical narratives, i.e. of prevailing interpretations of past events, it is upon those who want to change things for the better, for the future, to challenge and correct such interpretations and propose and promote alternative revisionist historical narratives. Are narratives important or just stories that more or less have no effect on us?
Well, unfortunately, they're extremely important. I mean, you see the way governments can continue to shape our perceptions of things with sometimes called propaganda. Sometimes these days is a term of our kind of talking points that get endlessly repeated. Yes, the narrative matters. In the narrative about World War II, generally speaking, there are different versions in different countries. But the one that most of us grew up with here in this country is, of course, you have this kind of heroic Roosevelt dragging this unenlightened isolationist country, despite its own selfish impulses, you know, into a noble crusade to rid the world of fascism, that in the end, despite obvious losses, everyone will admit, of course, that a lot of bad things happened in the war, but still that the story is basically edifying and it led to this kind of just and noble outcome. It was the good war. Well, I don't want to completely deny that we should have something to believe in, I think, as Americans. And the Second World War is perhaps a little bit better to shape this kind of narrative around than, let's say, the First World War. And it's a little bit less painful, probably, than the Civil War, where obviously you had, you know, the country kind of being scarred to its foundations. But there are problems with it. To begin with, setting aside the outcomes of the war in Eastern Europe and Asia, which I assume we'll talk about as we go, if you simply look at what happens to the United States, of course, you do get this rise in this kind of almost unaccountable national security state, going back really as far as the Lend-Lease Act of March 1941, where essentially Congress signs over a lot of its discretionary authority over not just budgetary matters, but effectively the ability to kind of shape and mold this vast hydraulic force that is the U.S. economy in any direction the president chooses. So the president could simply shape his own foreign policy without regard to congressional or public opinion, which is exactly what happens in the war. So there's no real oversight from Congress. There's no real public oversight. Eventually, you get a kind of overweening executive branch making policy on its own, everything from, again, Lend-Lease to Roosevelt's doctrine of unconditional surrender to the Morgenthau Plan, which I talk about in the book, these policies, which are hugely consequential and almost entirely really untouched or unaccountable by either Congress or public opinion. You know, and in the end, I mean, it's something I kind of allude to at the end of the book that, you know, despite some of the positive outcomes of the war, I mean, obviously Hitler eventually being overthrown and in fact killed effectively in battle and Nazi Germany being eradicated and the death camps being liberated. Obviously, the positive outcomes one can point to, but there was a huge price, a huge cost for this victory. Not just in terms of the fates of the people that ended up under Soviet communist rule or influence or Soviet satellite states, but also for the belligerent countries themselves, including the United States, which never really did revert to its kind of pre-1941 state. This overweening executive branch is something, I suppose, that we simply take for granted now.
What do you think differentiates a good historian from a bad historian?
I think it starts with the questions you ask. Again, the kind of the traditional books that some of them by popular historians, some of them by academic historians, which are less read, but which just kind of ask the same questions over and over again. And they're effectively aren't really even asking questions. They're just kind of taken as given a certain outcome or a certain narrative that has to be told in a certain way, maybe buffed or polished. Maybe they might question tiny little bits and pieces around the edges, but they basically agree on all the fine points. I think you have to start with the questions. You have to start with really basic questions, questions that sometimes, I'll give you an example of this. So in the book, it's simply asserted in nearly all the books that, you know, of course, Overlord and D-Day has to happen when they're talking about this, the big three at Tehran, Stalin, Churchill, and Roosevelt, that it's just a given, it's a done deal. Obviously, Churchill was completely wrong with this so-called Mediterranean or Adriatic stratagem. It was utterly crazy. And Stalin, of course, points out when he's trying to cut the Allies off the pass and trying to get them to invade northern France, heavily fortified, of course, northern France across the English Channel. Stalin says, well, the Balkans are far from Germany. And everyone just thought, well, you know, obviously that's true. Well, I'm the kind of historian that asks questions. So I say, are the Balkans far from Germany? And then I actually looked at a map and I counted up the distances. I looked at some of the possible landing spots like Trieste. And I actually just simply counted on the map. You know, how far are they from Munich, for example? In fact, it's nearly twice as close as, let's say, Normandy or Calais are from the Rhine. So that, in fact, Stalin was lying and no one really called him out on it. Yes, there were other regions, logistics, roads, railroads, etc. Obviously, some of the mountain passes are difficult in the Subcarpathians and the Transylvanian Alps. You could bypass the Alps if you landed in Yugoslavia, but you still had some other mountain ranges to deal with. All those things are true. On the other hand, if you simply ask a really simple question, you sometimes end up with a really interesting answer, but you have to ask the question.
What are some lessons we can learn from the First World War before doing a deep dive into the Second?
Well, I mean, the First World War, I mean, that is a huge subject. I've written a lot on the origins of the war, and some of what I've kind of tried to learn from the outbreak of the war, effectively the lesson is that it didn't have to happen, that a number of statesmen made fateful decisions, some of which were based on false or mistaken premises, that there was a lot of contingency, for example, that didn't necessarily have to break out the way that it did. But for that very reason, the statesmen who made these decisions bear a grave and great responsibility. But also that I think the pat narrative we're usually told about kind of German premeditation and war guilt in 1914, is based on certain assumptions, and in part because we actually have much greater access to the German files, particularly the files of the German Foreign Office, than we do with some of the other powers like Russia and France, that there's always going to be a lot that we don't know about the story. And it's always worth revisiting and trying to go back to the extent it's possible to the original sources. But effectively, that history doesn't have to happen. I mean, people were always asking me when I was talking about my books on the First World War. Back then, it was more actual radio interviews than podcasts. This is about 5, 6, 7 years ago. They're often asking me what the sort of the pat lessons are. And I don't think there really are pat lessons. You know, I don't think that, let's say, Germany as a rising power is exactly the same as China as a rising power today, or the rise of Russian power. The analogies always kind of break down on closer examination. But what is important to learn is that history does not have to happen in a certain way. There are always alternatives. And unfortunately, statesmen, and these days I suppose you'd have to expand that category to include perhaps tech and pharmaceutical executives along with statesmen, and of course media titans and social media executives, they bear grave responsibility for their actions. And I really do hope that we find a way to hold their feet to the fire.
And before getting into Stalin's role in the war, is there anything we should know about the Russian Revolution in either 1905 or 1917?
Oh, well, those are big subjects. I mean, I suppose, in the interest of time, I'll kind of skip ahead at least to 1917. So that when you look at the Bolsheviks seizing power in the way in which their approach to the world, particularly their approach to kind of foreign policy, helps to inform the events of the Second World War. The main thing to know, of course, is that they have an essentially binary view of a foreign policy of the world. It all basically comes down to, of course, the communist state, the kind of utopia in process that they're trying to make, and then the hostile outside world. And in some ways, I don't actually put it this way in the book, in part because I think I was already provoking enough people. It bears a certain resemblance to the idea in Islam between the house abode, depending on how you translate this, Dar al-Islam and Dar al-Harb, that is to say the house of war. This is the world outside Islam before they've submitted. It's not exactly the same thing in communism, but it's basically the same premise. That is to say, the world will eventually all become communist. And in the meantime, you're supposed to, of course, support the world's first communist state and all of its struggles with other states around the world, which does not always mean, it usually means you're seeking to topple capitalist governments, but not always. You can actually see this in the 21 conditions of the Communist International, which were first imposed on the member parties of the Communist International in 1920, that one of the conditions is that communists around the world are supposed to effectively further the aims of the Soviet Union, because, of course, it was the first so-called proletarian or communist state. So communists at times, they should, let's say, of course, work to topple hostile capitalist governments. But at other times, if those governments are helping the Soviet Union, such as, for example, Britain and the United States during the Second World War with Lend-Lease, then that would be counterproductive. And so instead, they should support those governments. But you see this playing out in the most obvious and almost egregious of ways in the Second World War, so that when Stalin signs his pact with Hitler, the so-called Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of August 1939, and then the following spring, Hitler and Nazi Germany, when they invade France and the Low Countries, French communists are literally instructed not to resist the German invasion, because Hitler was an ally of the Soviet Union, so that it was in the interest of the Soviet Union that Hitler conquer France and weaken the capitalist powers. Now, there was probably a slightly more, shall we say, an un, stated premise there. I think Stalin was hoping that the war would be a little more equal between Germany and the Western capitalist powers. He hoped they would destroy each other a little bit more thoroughly in a war of attrition. He didn't realize that the Germans were going to rout everyone quite so easily. But still, his fundamental foreign policy doesn't really change. The events of the day might produce a different conclusion vis-a-vis crises in Poland, Czechoslovakia, France, what have you. But the basic aim remains the same, which is the expansion of the boundaries of communism through whatever means are necessary and appropriate and opportunistic for the time.
In Chapter 3, titled Strategic Coup in Washington, and Chapter 28, Tehran and Cairo, you mention the Venona Files. What are the Venona Files?
Well, so these were, there was a program of kind of decrypting these cables wired between Moscow and mostly Washington, along with a few other consulates in the United States, where eventually the identities of some Americans were discovered who had met with or informed on a regular basis Soviet handlers and Soviet intelligence, people like Alger Hiss, for example, in the State Department, or Harry Dexter White, Assistant Secretary of the Treasury under Henry Morgenthau. There are other names that have been kind of bandied about who might have been alluded to in some of this correspondence, but whose names aren't explicitly named. We now have a pretty good idea of at least who many, not all, but many of the informants and spies were working to either inform or simply serve the interests of the Soviet government, particularly in Washington during the war and in various branches of the U.S. government, along with others who get mentioned, who might have also just been serving information more generally. It wasn't necessarily government secrets, but just trying to help the Soviet Union in whatever means necessary. So we do have a pretty good idea. I mean, there used to be controversies about people like Alger Hiss. There's still maybe a few lonely defenders. We're still going to claim that, in fact, the Venona decrypts don't necessarily prove that Hiss was a Soviet agent. And I suppose some of this is just partly a matter of taste. It's always difficult to prove these things to anyone's full satisfaction if they're really committed to a certain idea. But the basic fact that the U.S. government was heavily penetrated by Soviet intelligence, that many employees of the U.S. government were working for and informing the Soviet government, is no longer really in dispute.
Richard Haass, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, wrote a book titled The World, An Introduction, in which he says that there are a lot of wars that sort of are blunders that turn from something small into something big. The Second World War is not one of those cases. You have a clear-cut case of Germany, Japan, and Italy being the aggressors and the Allied forces being the defenders. How do you respond to that mindset?
Well, this is sort of the perfumed version of the Second World War, the simplistic notion that there was some unitary thing called fascism that somehow had kind of infected Germany, Italy, and Japan, and maybe not the identical way, but in very similar ways, and they formed this thing called the Axis, and they aggressed against not just foreign countries, but against kind of the rules of liberal international world order, etc. And one could definitely make the case in each turn. I mean, each of these countries did invade sovereign countries. In the case of Italy, as early as 1935 with Abyssinia, in the case of Japan, Manchuria, as early as 1931, in the case of Nazi Germany, I suppose you could count the Anschluss with Austria, although usually people would conventionally date this either to the occupation of kind of rump Bohemian Czechoslovakia in March 1939 or the invasion of Poland on September 1st, 1939. The problem with it, of course, is it ignores the role of the Soviet Union, which in many ways was just as revisionist and aggressive a power as the others. The Soviets invaded seven countries between 1939 and 1941. However, because Hitler and Nazi Germany invaded the Soviet Union in June 1941, thus sort of throwing the Soviets inadvertently and almost accidentally into the camp of Britain and later Britain's allies in the war, this was kind of swept into the memory hole as inconvenient to the fact that Stalin and Hitler had collaborated for effectively 21 months at the beginning of the Second World War, had jointly invaded Poland in 1939. In the case of the Soviets, even more opportunistically, they waited until the Germans had invaded Poland first and destroyed most of Poland's armies, air force, etc., before invading, although there was still a lot of fighting. It was not by any means a peaceful invasion. The Soviets pretended they weren't invading. Of course, they were invading. Actually did invade in a hostile sense. And in some ways, it was even more obnoxious. They literally call in Poland's ambassador and say, your country no longer exists. They arrest him. They send him to the gulag. This is on September 17th, 1939, in case anyone is curious, because most people don't know that date, because it just kind of gets glossed over rather quickly in most of the histories. The Soviets are treated as this kind of maybe junior partner auxiliary in Nazified Europe, rather than a kind of a fellow jackal that, in fact, in many ways was a more successful aggressor than Mussolini's Italy. So, you know, there's an element of truth, I suppose, in what Richard Haas says, but it's also important to know what is left out. And when you leave out the Soviet Union and you ignore that entire history, then you really are, I think, doing a serious, doing violence to the truth about the Second World War.
One more thing on this topic. If I had to steel man the opposition to this book, one might say, World War II was Hitler's war because his actions were the primary source of conflict. Seizing power in 1933, remilitarizing the Rhineland, ignoring the Versailles Treaty, invading Czechoslovakia, Austria, Poland, Denmark, Norway, Belgium, the Netherlands, France, Russia, the Channel Islands of Britain, Italy in 1943, and on December 11th, 1941, declaring war on America. How is this not Hitler's war? Final comments on this thinking.
Well, it's obvious to see why a lot of people would prefer to put it that way. You lay out all those events, and you're right, it seems like an open and clear shut case, just like the idea that the war was about kind of German Nazism, fascism, Italian fascism, and Japanese militarism. But yeah, you can definitely make that case, and you can tell the story in that way. I just think it leaves out a lot of the picture. Not just the period of collaboration I talked about with the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, but who was actually in the driver's seat in terms of those negotiations, who got a better deal, who had the more leverage, and effectively who wanted the war to break out in September 1939. Hitler, if you actually look at this, although these actions do, of course, provoke this powerful counter-reaction and eventually this grand allied coalition against Hitler. When Hitler moved into Poland, when he invaded Poland on September 1st, 1939, he was, of course, hoping that Britain and France would not declare war. In fact, earlier, he had been hoping to cut a deal with Poland, which had been effectively allied, or at the very least friendly, to Nazi Germany between 1934 and 1939. It was largely because of the British overtures to Poland, and particularly the so-called guarantee to Poland in March of 1939, March 31st, Chamberlain's notorious guarantee, not of Poland's full territorial integrity, but of her independence, which left unfortunate room for leeway and interpretation both in Poland and in Germany. There are a lot of people, such as A.G.B. Taylor, who've actually pointed at Britain's role in the outbreak of the war, to some extent issuing this guarantee to Poland, blowing up the relationship between Poland and Nazi Germany, giving the Germans effectively this pretext to move forward with their war plans to invade Poland. And there's something to be said for that argument, except, of course, it doesn't necessarily account once again for the role of the Soviet Union. Stalin, by negotiating this pact with Hitler, the so-called Molotov-Ribbentrop, more formally Moscow Pact of August 23rd, 1939, Stalin's precise intention was to bring about a war, to provoke a war between Hitler and the Western powers. And this is exactly what happens. And this war was in Stalin's interest because he wanted those powers to destroy themselves. He wanted them to destroy one another. It didn't work out exactly as Stalin had hoped and planned, but that was the intention. Now, Hitler, in other words, was effectively lured into it. It was almost like being lured into a trap. And in fact, you know, facing this, once again, the British blockade, it was conceivable for Hitler, now that he had the Soviets essentially on side, sending him raw materials to allow him to evade the British blockade and so on. But the essential catalyst that allows this type of war to break out, that allows Germany even to contemplate a European war, is the Pact with Stalin. The last thing I'll say about this is that obviously, Hitler, in a lot of ways, is a more dynamic statesman. That is to say, you know, he wasn't as patient as Stalin was. He was the one who kept trying to force the action. But he was also much less successful than Stalin was at achieving his objectives. In the end, of course, he's a colossal failure, whereas Stalin ends up winning the war by any objective measure and conquering vast amounts of territory and enslaving whole new populations in Europe and Asia by 1945. The war in Asia, in a lot of ways, which Hitler, of course, doesn't even participate in. I don't know how people can call it Hitler's war. You're right, Hitler declared war on the United States on December 11th, but the Germans were not a belligerent in the Pacific or the Asian War, neither on the mainland nor at sea. They played no role whatsoever in that conflict. So that has always been, I think, the area where the argument finally breaks down, that Hitler is kind of the sole catalyst for the conflict. You can't really explain almost any of Japanese actions in terms of Hitler and his priorities. In fact, Pearl Harbor is something that kind of to some extent catches Hitler by surprise and acts in this peculiar way by declaring war on the United States, which was a rather self-defeating decision if ever there was one. But it doesn't necessarily explain either Pearl Harbor or any of the events in the Pacific between 1931 and 1945. I mean, the last thing, of course, is if the World War really does break out in Manchuria in 1931, Hitler isn't even in power yet. And when it finally ends in September 1945, Hitler's been dead for 4 months.
Hitler invaded Russia in 1941 unprovoked. True or false?
True and false, unprovoked in the literal sense that I don't think there's any evidence that the Russians were on the cusp of invading. So this idea that it was kind of this defensive preventive strike, and some historians, some revisionists have gone that far, I don't agree with that. The provocation was more, it was kind of a series of provocations. Going back to fall 1940 in particular, when German and Soviet interests begin to clash in the Balkans, particularly over places like Romania with its oil, Finland, not in the Balkans, but Finland was also significant because of its nickel, and Stalin basically demanded that Germany withdraw her troops from Finland along with Romania, both of them significant for their economic resources. The Balkans as a whole, and even Turkey by way of the Balkans, supplied Germany with most of her chrome, a lot of key metals. About half of her petroleum was coming from Romania, and Stalin was not only demanding the Germans withdraw from Romania, he was demanding the right to invade Bulgaria, basically to station troops, to land troops at the Bosporus, and effectively control Istanbul and the Turkish Straits. And Hitler reacted quite violently to what he saw almost as an ultimatum. The Germans were inviting the Soviets to join the Tripartite Pact between Germany, Italy, and Japan, to actually join as a full partner. Admittedly, the Germans wanted there to be certain ground rules on what the Soviets would be allowed to do and focus on, but he absolutely invited the Soviets into the pact. And Stalin's response was effectively to say, we won't join your pact unless you withdraw your troops from Finland and Romania and allow us to invade Bulgaria and station troops at the Straits, and forced Japan to make certain concessions on Sakhalin, the Kuril Islands, etc. Hitler saw that as an ultimatum. And you can actually pretty precisely date when the Germans began their serious war planning in December 1940 to this breakdown with Stalin, where Hitler doesn't even respond to this offer, which he saw as insulting, and he unloads on the Bulgarian minister in this kind of temper tantrum. So the provocation was more about kind of these clash of interests and Stalin really acting like a kind of jumped up Mussolini and trying to boss Hitler around. Now, the Soviet military buildup was significant, but I don't think that actually factored that much into Hitler's thinking, aside from kind of providing, obviously, targets, particularly for the Luftwaffe during the invasion. You know, they had a pretty good idea, at least, of what the Soviet armor was like near the frontier. Plus, the Soviet war preparations were serious, but I don't think the Soviets were anywhere near ready by June 1941.
Chapter 22 was titled The Hinge of Fate, December 1941, in which you mention a trade route to Vladivostok, which is in the northeastern part of, yeah. I'm sorry, I practiced saying it for like 2 minutes before we started and I still got it wrong. What is important about this trade route from San Francisco to that region of Russia?
Well, we're talking about lend-lease shipments and aid, of course, and there are a number of things that are significant about it. One of which is that the aid route that Stalin preferred, effectively by way of the North Atlantic and parts of the North Sea, and eventually the Arctic and the Barents Sea, basically to these far northern Soviet ports of Murmansk and Archangel, was dangerous. Of course, you had to brave not only these kind of cold, frigid waters and ice flows, but also, of course, U-boat attacks, Luftwaffe attacks, extremely dangerous. It took a while to get an alternative route by way of Iran up and going, in part because infrastructure needed to be built, a lot of port infrastructure and improvements to the roads and loading facilities and so on. But Vladivostok was quite interesting. On the one hand, it would have made a lot of sense before Pearl Harbor. However, Stalin refused to let the Americans use it before Pearl Harbor, when it actually was effectively a kind of a safe and neutral port for the U.S. to ship goods across the Pacific, not just from San Francisco, but Portland, Seattle, and other ports, Alaska as well. The reason it was significant for Stalin was actually once the U.S. and Japan were at war, Stalin had a neutrality pact with Japan, to which he was quite loyal, and he actually didn't necessarily mind if the Americans were going to effectively waste their own merchant marine tonnage, shipping resources, convoys, escorts, etc., shipping goods to him at Vladivostok. And they did so. They actually shipped more than 8.2 million tons of goods straight through Japanese territorial waters while at war with Japan during the Pacific War, including a huge ramp up over the last 14 months of the Pacific War, even as the bombing campaign against Tokyo and the mainland was accelerating. And eventually, of course, the A-bombs were dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It's a really bizarre story. I mean, there's even an angle where Stalin might have been hoping, it's hard to actually kind of prove this, of course, but he might have been hoping that the Americans might have even sustained losses on this route. It turned out, though, that Japan basically didn't bother most of these shipments. In the end, Roosevelt agreed to allow the Soviets to raise the hammer and sickle aboard most of these vessels, including dozens of Liberty ships, which were just effectively given to Stalin as gifts. And that way, since they were running up the Soviet flag, Japan wouldn't bother them and molest them, because the Japanese, they seemed almost amused by this, that the U.S. was actually wasting all this war material, ammunition, clothing, foodstuffs, and particularly gasoline. More than a million tons of refined motor and aviation gasoline are actually shipped mostly to Vladivostok across the Pacific during the war. And eventually, of course, Stalin uses all these goods and that gasoline to wait until Japan was nearly defeated, literally the day the second atomic bomb was dropped on Nagasaki, to declare war on Japan and carve out his empire in Northern Asia.
What is some more important information about Lend-Lease for us to really get the size and scope of whether this was, you know, some general assistance or this was really something that helped the Soviet empire become what it later became?
Well, I think it was hugely significant. I mean, to begin with, even what the Soviets were able to produce themselves required industrial inputs from the United States and Britain, particularly the United States. A lot of this is because after the Germans invaded in 1941, the Soviets lost huge swathes of territory. The Germans, for example, by conquering the Baltic area, they knocked out the entire complex for Red Army uniform and boot supply, and you know, everything from leather and boots to cloth and fabric and clothing, nearly all of which had to be supplied by the Americans. They lose huge amounts of iron ore, processing facilities, smelting facilities, you know, for manufacturing steel, armor, plate. They lose manganese. In particular, they lost aluminum, both the bauxite, the raw bauxite, and then also the aluminum smelting facilities, some of which was up in the north near Petrograd, St. Petersburg, Leningrad, as it was then called, some of it in Ukraine, lost to the Germans, so that the Americans have to end up shipping thousands of tons of aluminum every month. The Soviets used aluminum not just in the construction of warplanes, which all the belligerents did, but also in their own tanks. The Germans actually didn't, for example. They thought aluminum was too expensive. They didn't actually make their tanks, the Panzers, out of aluminum. But Stalin did. The T-34, the KV, most of the other series, the Stalin series of tanks, they were all basically made out of aluminum. I mean, it wasn't the only element. But it was a very significant element in the construction of tanks, so they needed that. In addition to this, in addition to all the raw material inputs and gasoline, which we've already talked about, foodstuffs, the famous Spam, also dehydrated borscht, millions of packets of dehydrated borscht that were feeding the Red Army in a literal sense. They could not have basically had the sustenance to function without this Lend-Lease aid. It's what was feeding the Red Army literally by 1943, 44, and 45. In addition to all that, you had the mobility. The Germans famously, although they did build some impressive tanks and very fancy warplanes, not only did they not have enough fuel eventually to get a lot of those planes in the air by 44 and 45, but long before that, they were running extremely short on motorized vehicles. And a lot of Barbarossa was underpowered. You know, they relied on horses and pack animals. And by 1943 and 1944, when the Red Army finally begins its long march to Berlin, it's basically riding on the tires, literally the rubber tires of Lend-Lease shipped to them. In fact, entire firm, like Firestone, had shipped over even industrial inputs, technology transfer. Whole plants were transferred to the Soviet Union. Then you also had the motorized vehicles, the Studebakers, the Willys Jeeps, the Fords, the Dodges, the Chevys, the Harley-Davidson motorcycles. You know, when they began Operation Bagration to conquer Belarusian parts of Poland, along with the Baltic area, in late June into July 1944, the Soviets are basically able to deploy more than 150,000 Lend-Lease motorized vehicles at a time when the Germans have precious few, if any. So the Soviets have the mobility. This is the mobility that allows them to conquer, to reconquer Belarus, to conquer Poland, to conquer eventually East Prussia and Germany, and then, of course, also to to conquer Manchuria, North Korea, and much of the rest of Northern Asia in 1945.
Between September 1st, 1939, and Operation Barbarossa, did Hitler offer? Did Hitler give Britain any peace offers in that time period?
Well, he did. I mean, obviously, you could sort of treat them as cynical or insincere, as first Chamberlain and later Churchill did. How serious was Hitler? Well, there's a Reichstag speech, for example, on October 6, 1939, after Poland has fallen and Stalin have kind of hashed out all the details of who gets what, swapping central Poland. The Germans get that. Stalin gets Lithuania, a few other border adjustments here and there. And Poland, obviously, the tragedy of Poland has begun. But, you know, Hitler does kind of say that he might consider reconstituting at least part of around Poland in exchange for some type of a lasting peace. I don't think Britain, you know, even Chamberlain, despite being pilloried for appeasement in 1938, but 1939, he was fully committed to the war. So I don't think he ever really took this seriously. And admittedly, it was self-serving on Hitler's part. You saw similar offers after the fall of France in the Low Countries, you know, by way of kind of third-party intermediaries, by way of the Vatican, in some cases by way of U.S. officials, where Hitler was trying to kind of open up a line of communication with Churchill. You know, Churchill, I think he did think about it. He considered it. They had to at least kind of discuss in the cabinet whether it was even conceivable to cut some kind of a deal with Hitler. I think he just thought it was something he just couldn't really stomach. I mean, his conscience, you know, his notion of honor, Britain's honor. Cutting some type of a deal which would allow Hitler to dominate the continent in exchange for preserving Britain's empire. You know, how sincere Hitler was in these offers, I mean, no one knows for sure, of course. It does seem like that, let's say, making peace with Britain, maybe Hitler would have turned on Stalin more quickly. I mean, it's hard to know. There was some discussion surrounding the Rudolf Hess mission where he crashes down in kind of the, you know, in Scotland and is interrogated by the British. And Hitler kind of disowns him, but, you know, a lot of people think, in fact, this was, if not official, then a semi-official peace overture. But Churchill, once again, of course, didn't want to talk about it. You know, maybe Hitler already by then planning to invade the Soviet Union was trying to kind of quiet down the other fronts and get Britain to make some kind of a tactical peace agreement. I think by then it was almost inconceivable. There's simply no way Churchill would have considered it. But again, going back to 1939 and the kind of the old AJP Taylor argument about, you know, the origins of the war. You know, Britain not convinced the Poles that Britain and France. I think the real tragedy, to some extent, lies in this almost miscommunication, where the Poles really think that Britain and France have given this solemn pledge to come to Poland's aid if Nazi Germany invades. And in practice, of course, they do very little to help Poland in September 1939. I think the roots of the tragedy lie there. That I think Britain was intending by then, by, you know, basically by spring, certainly by August 1939, to stand up to Nazi Germany, but that didn't necessarily translate into doing anything very active to help Poland. And I think that Poland, based on that slightly misleading promise, you know, Poland is, of course, engulfed in horrors of the war earlier than anyone else. And Poland is ultimately the victim of the war. I mean, to me, the most really shocking thing about the outcome of the war, you know, talk about the just war, the good war, Poland has still not received reparations for either Germany or the Soviet Union. They applied as recently as 2017 to the German Chancellor's office when Angela Merkel, of course, sitting in the Chancellor's office, dismissed this, saying, well, you forfeited your right to reparations by solemn engagement in 1953, when, of course, Poland was a Soviet satellite, an occupied Soviet satellite state. So it's an absurd argument the Germans are giving. And there's no way, of course, Putin's Russia is ever going to agree to this kind of thing. They still haven't received reparations. I mean, it's astonishing.
There was an article published by the New York Times, January 2nd, 1972, titled War Entry Plans Laid to Roosevelt, in which they discuss a meeting that Churchill and Roosevelt had in August of 1940 in Newfoundland. And Churchill said that Roosevelt was determined that they should come in, and they were attempting to provoke Germany into creating an incident. We also have the diaries of Henry Stimson, as late as November 1941, saying we had a meeting and the general consensus was everything was to be done to provoke an incident. There's also a document by Arthur McCollum titled the McCollum Memo, in which they add 8 ways they could provoke a Japanese attack to justify entrance into the war on Britain's behalf. Are you familiar with any of this research, and do you think Pearl Harbor was intentionally provoked?
Oh, I am familiar with some of the debates and controversies surrounding Pearl Harbor. I leave most of them alone in the book, in part because I'm provoking a lot of other controversies. My view on not just Pearl Harbor, but really the broader subject. I mean, you know, there are a couple of different things going on. On the one hand, you have Britain and Churchill very clearly trying to sort of angle and manipulate the United States into the war. On the other hand, you have Roosevelt himself, probably looking for various pretexts, even while, of course, famously, he's promising on the campaign trail in late October 1940 that your boys are not going to be sent off to die in any foreign wars. You know, even while he knows that, of course, you know, he and Churchill and some of his envoys, and particularly so-called Wild Bill Donovan, the founder of the OSS. I mean, if you really look into this story, and there are some interesting books on this, a book by Henry Hemmings, I think Janet Conant did a book on this subject as well, that actually looked into the origins of the OSS, that essentially the entire thing was created by the British. It was sort of the brainchild, this is the foreigner of the CIA, it was the brainchild of a Canadian, William Stevenson, you know, actually had this kind of dirty tricks office he was running in Manhattan, where they would do things like, you know, they created this phony map showing, you know, Hitler's plans to conquer the Western Hemisphere, and Roosevelt shows this to the public. The whole thing was utterly phony. I mean, there are all kinds of things, and it's not really what my book is about, because I'm mostly looking, of course, at kind of the Soviet side of the war. There are all kinds of things that I think do need to be explored, and some of them have already been explored about U.S. foreign policy in 1940 and 1941. There are obviously layers of deception involved. There's also this interesting story that Thomas Fleming first broke, I think back in the 80s, and then he later put this in his book, New Dealer's War, suggesting that Roosevelt had actually been the leaker. There was this big manhunt for the leaker who leaked this, the so-called Rainbow Five, the war plan involving the creation of this massive army by 1943, invasion of the mainland. And this runs on the cover of Chicago Tribune on December 4th, 1941, so just 3 days before Pearl Harbor. And Fleming's argument is that effectively this was Roosevelt himself leaking this in order to provoke Hitler, he hoped, into a declaration of war. The only way in which I think some of the arguments begin to not necessarily contradict themselves, but there are certain anomalies that start to creep in if you look at the weeks before Pearl Harbor. Clearly, I think there were a lot of ways in which the U.S. was provoking Japan. I mean, to begin with, of course, with this kind of de facto oil embargo, which really almost to some extent was kind of the clock was ticking on Japan and really her war efforts, and could she even really keep prosecuting the war much longer without getting some kind of access to oil resources? Economic pressure, sanctions, the refusal to negotiate. Japan obviously makes all these kind of offers to negotiate some type of a compromise settlement vis-a-vis China, Asia, to try to get concessions from the U.S., economic concessions. Now, all of this is true, but the part that is a little tricky from Roosevelt's perspective is, of course, he doesn't really want to focus on Japan. That is to say, he wants a war in Europe. He wants the U.S. to enter the war with Nazi Germany. He's not sure how to bring that about. So that in the end, he actually almost has, I think, some cold feet at the last minute. I mean, the way I put it in the book, and you can argue this about Harry Dexter White and his role in helping to pen the so-called whole note, this almost ultimatum that the U.S. finally sends to Japan. Roosevelt, there are hints in November 1941 that he actually does want to back down a little bit with Japan. And it's partly because, you know, he doesn't want to get sucked into an Asian war without getting his European war, which is his real priority. In a lot of ways, I mean, the reason I think this kind of almost like Machiavellian interpretation of Roosevelt and Churchill, it's not that they weren't trying to get the U.S. into the war. They were, but they didn't know how to do it. And in fact, in the end, Hitler kind of solves their problem for us by declaring war. There's an interesting new book that's just come out, co-authored by Brendan Sims. I'm actually forgetting the other author's name, in part because I guess I know Brendan, where they're trying to look at these critical days in 1941 in December, between Pearl Harbor and Hitler's declaration of war, where, you know, it really wasn't a done deal. I mean, there are a lot of ways in which Hitler was manipulated, but also probably miscalculated. And in the end, of course, it's a colossal blunder. Had Hitler not declared war on the U.S., I think Roosevelt would have actually been in a very difficult position. And so would Churchill. You know, if suddenly the U.S. were in a Pacific war, but without being at war with Nazi Germany, they would have been very hard-pressed to get the U.S. To focus on, you know, lend-lease aid to Russia, for example, or actively helping Britain's war effort in Europe. They would have been in a real pickle. I think in the end, you know, Hitler fell into this trap and made things much easier on Roosevelt than perhaps they needed to be.
Pat Buchanan says, On September 1st, 1939, 70 years ago, the German army crossed the Polish frontier. On September 3rd, Britain declared war. 6 years later, 50 million Christians and Jews had perished. Britain was broken and bankrupt. Germany, a smoldering ruin. Europe had served as the site of the most murderous combat known to man, and civilians had suffered worse horrors than the soldiers. By May 1945, Red Army hordes occupied all the great capitals of Central Europe. Vienna, Prague, Budapest, Berlin. 100 million Christians were under the heel of the most barbarous tyranny in history, the Bolshevik regime of the greatest terrorist of them all, Joseph Stalin. What are your thoughts on whether or not this war was worth it at all?
Oh, that's such a difficult question. I mean, I suppose it depends on, you know, what stage you're talking about, what aspect of the war you're talking about. I mean, obviously, I think everyone would agree that in the end, eradicating Hitler's regime and liberating both the concentration and the death camps, dotting Germany, and obviously, especially Poland when it came to the death camps, those were worthwhile objectives. But of course, that begs the question of when and how were those camps created? While obviously some of the camps, such as Dachau, long predated the war, there were concentration camps. There were, of course, even more brutal concentration camps, forced labor camps, dotting the Soviet Union. And those dated back even further, of course, to the days immediately after the Russian Revolution of 1917, going back as far as 1918. So the question, of course, is, on the one hand, you have the debates about the Holocaust and sort of how did it come about? Was it inevitable functionalist interpretations? There are a lot of different questions there. But of course, I do think that ultimately it is true that you cannot conceive of something as horrific as both the Holocaust and what is sometimes called the bloodlands of Eastern Europe, because obviously horrific atrocities are being committed by the Soviets too on the Eastern Front. You can't conceive of any of those things, you know, absent a European war breaking out in September 1939. It's not that Hitler had benign intentions towards Jews of Germany and Central Europe, but until 1941-42, until the war kind of bogs down in the Eastern Front, and literally until, I mean, this is really quite interesting. You talk about the declaration of war in the United States, Hitler's declaration of war in the United States on December 11, 1941. Most Holocaust scholars now agree that the final mechanics, you know, the leading to the Wannsee Protocols, the idea that they were going to move to this kind of mass industrialized slaughter of European Jewry, that Hitler actually announces this to his aides, I mean, it's slightly kind of indirect way, but the momentum is pretty clear, on December 12, 1941. You know, so to some extent, that war, the fact that it becomes this global war, you know, with the United States in, is the necessary precondition for those horrors to come. You know, which again doesn't mean the U.S. bears responsibility for Hitler's actions, obviously not, nor that Britain bears responsibility for Hitler's actions, rather, but that the waging of this war provides the essential smokescreen, pretext, justification, etc., for what eventually Hitler, Himmler, Heydrich, and the others set about doing, while obviously also providing the kind of the canvas for Stalin's conquests, along with the fuel and the mobility that I talked about for Stalin's armies. It's a horrible story. I don't think that, you know, if you were to go back to August 1939, there are any great scenarios. That is to say, something bad is probably going to happen vis-a-vis Poland. Stalin is probably going to make some moves. Japan has, of course, by then already invaded China. So it's not like there are any particularly happy outcomes there. But that said, I don't think that all of the horrors to come were fated or inevitable. I do think that in the end, a lot of serious mistakes were made. And to begin with, I think, again, if Britain and France wanted to issue this guarantee to Poland, which effectively kind of gave Hitler a pretext for invading Poland, once, of course, Poland refused to negotiate any type of a deal over the corridor in Gdansk, Danzig, etc. If they were willing to go to war for Poland, they should have actually gone to war for Poland. In fact, they didn't really do that in September 1939. It was the most asinine and half-hearted intervention of all time. That is to say, the aid that Britain and France give to Poland is so infinitesimal as to barely even register. You know, France sending a few troops across the border near Saarbrück, and Britain dropping some propaganda leaflets. That was about it. I think that the roots of the tragedy lie there, in this kind of huge gap between, you know, the promises made and the actions taken by Britain and France in 1939, along with obviously Hitler's own genocidal intentions and those of Stalin.
Dropping nuclear weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were necessary for world peace to exist. True or false?
Well, I don't think they were necessary for world peace to exist. I think that by the stage that the war had reached in July, August 1945, I can see why Truman and his advisors thought that dropping was necessary in order to compel Japan into effectively unconditional surrender. Where I differ from some of the arguments about this, and I mean, there have been a lot of interesting arguments about or the strategic justification of the dropping of the two atomic bombs. And there are revisionists who say, of course, that it was really mostly about intimidating the Soviets. I think all of those arguments, interesting as they are, kind of miss the point. I think the real problem or the real mistake was insisting on unconditional surrender. So this goes all the way back to Casablanca in early 1943, and it's reaffirmed. And even after Roosevelt's death, Truman insists on unconditional surrender for Japan. And there are a lot of people, including former ambassador to Tokyo, Joseph Grew, including former President Herbert Hoover, who were trying to advise Roosevelt at the time, you know, along with even some military intelligence analysts, so the most of them were kind of low ranking, that, you know, Japan was on the ropes, that morale was kind of plummeting. Yes, despite these dramatic kamikaze attacks, that in fact, Japan really had no hope. You know, the Japanese economy was already in ruins. You know, Japan had already kind of been bombed to smithereens, and that what was really needed was kind of a way out, some type of compromise negotiation, perhaps allowing Hirohito to remain on his throne, perhaps kind of a one condition acceptance or two conditions, something short of utter subjection and unconditional surrender. I think by insisting on unconditional surrender, then yes, these other arguments come into play. Perspective after Okinawa, how many casualties would have there been with an invasion of the mainland versus dropping the atomic bombs? In that sense, obviously, they're going to save some American lives, maybe even arguably Japanese lives, despite the obvious victims of the A-bombs themselves. Maybe you're going to save some lives versus invading the mainland. But of course, it's all based on what I think was a mistaken premise, which is that unconditional surrender was the only way. It not only, of course, gave in the end the impetus to the dropping of the A-bombs, but it also gave the impetus for the Soviet entry into the war and effectively the spread of communism, first, of course, into Manchuria and kind of Sakhalin and the Kuril Islands in North Korea, but then ultimately, because of the linking up of the Red Army and Mao's armies to China, we're still living with the consequences today. I think it was a huge strategic mistake. I think all kinds of options should have been pursued and considered in 1945, short of unconditional surrender of Japan.
You wrote a book called The Red Millionaire, a political biography of Willy Munzenberg, Moscow secret propaganda czar in the West, 1917 to 1940. What is some important information about Willy Munzenberg?
Oh boy, this is sort of a blast from the past. My very first book, probably the least read of all of my books, although it did make a few ripples, I think, back when it came out about 17 or 18 years ago. No, I found Munzenberg fascinating, in part because I kind of picked up these stories and these legends about his friendship with Lenin and how he kind of parlayed this into this media empire in Weimar Germany between the wars. And some people, there were all these different analogies people would use. They would compare him to Hearst, kind of an American media baron. Some people have compared him to Hugenberg, this so-called capitalist German media baron. A few other cheeky people compared him to Rupert Murdoch, the kind of modern right-leaning media baron. Who still owns a lot of important newspapers and television stations such as Fox News around the world. I was intrigued by these comparisons. I ultimately discovered, though, that they were all slightly off, to put it mildly, that although Munzenberg did have a media empire and he helped to publish a lot of newspapers, and there even kind of had his foot in the Soviet film industry, and you know, there were a lot of other kind of print journals and propaganda and a lot of agitprop meetings, that in the end there was something quite hollow at the core of nearly all of them. To begin with, his newspapers didn't have very many readers. You could sort of tell this when you looked at the lack of advertisements, you know, even in like Sunday editions, they simply didn't really have a lot of readers, that a lot of what he was doing was exaggerating his own skills and influence in order to essentially cajole money out of the Kremlin, that in the end, the Communist International, the whole thing, of course, floated on this sea of subsidies from Moscow. This is what allowed Moscow to control all of the different communist parties, was that it paid for all of them. And this is something that, believe it or not, people used to deny in this country. They said, oh, the American Communist Party is a totally self-sustaining enterprise. It has nothing to do with Moscow. Now, we now know this is all a lie, that the whole thing was financed. I mean, right up to 1987, 1988, the Soviet government was still paying, you know, the steep rent for, like, the Manhattan headquarters of the U.S. Communist Party, that they were paying for all of this, that, you know, Mensurberg's news, it was all paid for by the Kremlin. And a lot of it was paid for out of the kind of inherited loot of Tsarist Russia. Eventually, the Soviets did acquire certain revenue and income streams from, you know, importing, exporting certain raw materials and later weapons and so on. But that ultimately, it all just depended on subsidies. And more interestingly, too, is, it was all accounted in U.S. dollars. So I discovered that the official language of the Communist International was German, and the currency of the Communist International was actually the U.S. dollar. But then in the end, it was just Soviet subsidies that kept all these things afloat. And that's effectively how they, you know, again, kind of used the lever to control communist parties and agents around the world, was because they paid for everything.
One more question about how this sort of influence is able to exist over such large masses. If you look at Russia, we have this very large geographical area, and we go from a Tsarist government getting overthrown by Bolsheviks. How did people know to start obeying these guys called Bolsheviks and no longer the Tsar? Did they just overthrow the capital and then they just started calling the shots and everyone sort of just went with it? How were they able to enforce something over such a large mass?
Well, they were terrifying, but of course it depended on force. I mean, what was, I think, ingenious and to some extent new about Lenin's approach to politics, he was a student of war, you know, he kept reading Clausewitz, so it was all about kind of, you know, balance of forces and so on. But the part that I don't think people have understood, that I write about in my book, The Russian Revolution, for example, is that the Bolsheviks targeted the military quite explicitly, quite deliberately, obviously ideologically as well. And if you actually look at the lyrics of Eugène Poitier's the Internationale, the anthem of international socialism, it was about, in fact, it was about an army mutiny. And the key line there is, you know, they'll know soon enough that our bullets are for our own generals, that effectively the capitalists or the ruling classes of the bourgeois had been foolish enough to arm the proletarians. Now, obviously, this is a gross simplification, but the idea that kind of the poor, those who had been conscripted into the armies, they had been armed. And so what you had to do was target the army with propaganda. And in fact, while the Bolsheviks did make some inroads among factory workers and other urbanites in Moscow and Petrograd, you can actually see in the election figures of 1917, the last free elections held in November 1917, that their best numbers actually came in certain army units that they had targeted. And obviously, it was partly peace propaganda. We're going to end the war. And this is a message that kind of resonated. But effectively, it was that the war was unjust. You know, you're fighting on behalf of these kind of, you know, capitalist oppressors and the Tsar and Bloody Nicholas and all that. So instead of turn your guns on your oppressors. So the idea is to turn the armies red. They don't win over everyone. It's just a matter of winning over enough so that when the armies begin to break down and the mutinies start to kind of spread through the armies in 1917. And then after the Bolsheviks take power and they immediately asked the Germans for a ceasefire, in part because, of course, Lenin had been financed by the Germans, which is to say was a German agent, rather, they saw him as useful. That's when the mutinies really spread, and the army just wants the soldiers to walk home, but they walk home with their weapons. And eventually, you know, those people are mobilized. You know, first, yes, in Petrograd, a few other cities, they have the Red Guards, they get weapons into their hands. The Civil War is fought out, of course, over the next several years. And in the end, it's not a matter of putting everyone under arms. It's a matter of putting enough people under arms and terrorizing the rest so that in the end they have a monopoly on force. Of course, they disarm everyone else and send their most dangerous opponents into camps or have them executed, Red Terror, etc. In the end, they have a monopoly on force, and that's what allows them to get their way.
Final question, sir. Thank you so much for being generous with your time. I think, you know, as evil as the National Socialist Party is, the fact that they didn't win the war, and there's not a lot of them proudly, you know, boasting today about their ideas, certainly in reasonable numbers. They're not in institutions of power. I think that's why your book is so important, to really focus on who the winners are and who people see as legitimate. According to EconLib, 17% of social scientists, professors, identify as Marxists, according to Real Time with Bill Maher. I forget what he cited, but it was a legitimate study. 29% of Generation Z thinks that communism is a legitimate form of political organization. Bill de Blasio, one of the most popular mayors in all of America, said all property in New York City should be collectively owned and voted on. Was Joseph McCarthy right?
Well, I don't know if de Blasio is actually that popular. I think his victory is dependent largely on extremely low turnout. And I'm not sure he would necessarily win many popularity polls in New York City today. But that said, if you look at all these things, I mean, was McCarthy right? It depends on right about what. I mean, the danger of, I suppose, communist influence spreading through government and through educational institutions, I suppose, in some general sense, certainly he was right to warn about it. You know, even if maybe kind of tactically and politically, he might have gone about it in a slightly slapdash and reckless and self-defeating way. But the broader point, look, I mean, it's not as if anyone really has an answer as to how to control this other than, I hope, improving history instruction. Really, you know, all the way back to grade school and through middle school and junior high and hopefully in the colleges. But I do think people have simply forgotten this history. And you're right. I mean, it's this kind of, I call almost this hypermnesia about Nazi Germany, that the Holocaust and Nazi Germany and Hitler, to some extent, is the only 20th century history that a lot of Americans know these days. And it's important to know the history of Nazi Germany and the Holocaust. But of course, if you don't know it in the context of what else was happening during the war, other things happening around the world, such as obviously the spread of Soviet communism, the fact that Stalin wins the war and Soviet communism spreads even further, even as Nazism is utterly discredited in 1945. Now, I do think it's slightly grotesque in a way that we devote so much energy and attention to studying, you know, a regime and a phenomenon which is essentially defunct, whereas, you know, as I think you rightly put it, communism actually still retains a lot of popularity. So I think in many ways, studying the history of communism is actually far more pressing and significant. No, I think we should study it all. I mean, I think people should learn history, you know, in all of its richness and color, but also in all of its horrors. And I do hope that at least some of my books, both the ones I've written and ones that I still have to write, will help to inform people about the real history of communism.
Any books you recommend on studying the crimes of communism, besides your own, of course?
Well, I am actually writing a new book on the history of communism. It won't be out for several years. I obviously recommend that one. I think the works of Mark Malley and Richard Pipes on the Soviet Union and Soviet history are important. There's actually a French thinker called Alain Besançon. Unfortunately, most of his books haven't been translated into English, but I think he actually understands sort of the phenomenon of communism both as a doctrine and ideology probably better than any American or British writers. As far as important books on Stalin, I mean, the books of Sebag Montefiore are all worth reading. Court of the Red Tsar, Young Stalin, his books on the Romanovs and the history of the Romanovs, his book on the Romanovs is also phenomenal. As far as kind of different aspects of communism, it was quite controversial, but the Black Book of Communism, the Livre Noir, which came out in France about a quarter century ago, people have disputed the figures and the estimates that the editor, Stéphane Courtois, came up with for the total number of victims of communist regimes. He kind of rounded everything up to about 100 million. And obviously, a lot of people find that to be slightly kind of oversimplified. It all depends on how you define victims and how you count up the different types of deaths in the different regimes and so on. It's a book, obviously, that has its detractors. I do think it's worth reading. I mean, the chapter on the Soviet Union alone by Nicholas Wirth is basically like a book unto itself. I do think it is worth reading. But I think a lot still remains to be said. I mean, I think there's still a lot that we don't know really about some of the regimes in Eastern Europe behind the Iron Curtain, a lot that we still don't know about Chinese communist history and even recent history of the Communist Party in China. And I think that there are a lot of important books on communist China. Frank de Kerter has written some wonderful books. But I do think a lot more work remains to be done.
The book is Stalin's War, A New History of World War II. Check a link in the description to purchase the book. Dr. McMeekin, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on, Keith. It was great fun.